Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the Dr. Will Show, where I interview educators and entrepreneurs on leveling up. Each episode, I zoom in someone who's dope, and we'll just sit back and have a conversation on what it means to live your best life. Now, if this is your first time checking out the podcast, this is the Mobile University for Entrepreneurs, and I'm your host, Dr. Will. Today's guest is Miriam Plotinsky. And we're going to be talking about her book. We're going to be talking about her sort of work as an author. Why did she become an author and things of that nature? And we're going to have a great conversation because if you're like me, you're ready for the school year to be over. I talked to my wife today and I was like, we either need a 4-day school week or school need to shut down in May 1st. I don't need to go to the end of May, or some people going to the June. We don't need to do that. We're tired.
We are very tired. I agree with that.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my gosh. So for those who will be listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Simplecast, Stitcher, and Audible, will you please introduce yourself, Miriam?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Miriam Plotinsky, and as Dr. Will mentioned, I am an author. I am also what's known as an instructional specialist for a very large school district here in Maryland. And instructional specialists essentially go into schools, provide support, partnership, professional development, and my area of specialty is secondary English language arts and literacy.
All right. So I'm always curious as to how people got to where they are. What did you think you'll be doing when you were growing up? And how did you find yourself in K-12 education?
So I definitely did not picture myself in education at all. And this is going to sound kind of funny, but my dream was to be an opera singer. And I actually started college with that intention. And I studied with a Metropolitan Opera singer, and I was very serious about it. And then at some point, I just kind of stopped enjoying it. And I also realized it wasn't going to be my path. I didn't know what my path was going to be. And the whole K-12 education thing happened. It was really an accident. I was walking through campus one day, and I think it was early in my sophomore year. And there's one of those kiosks that's on campus that has like the flyers all over it. I don't know if they still have those in this age of digital, whatever, but there are all these flyers everywhere. And I saw this advertisement for an orientation that was going to happen for people who wanted to become teachers. And I don't know what happened in that moment, because I had never, ever considered being a teacher. In fact, I was not a very engaged student academically. I wasn't, you know, nothing horrible, but it just wasn't my thing. I went to school to be social. I didn't go to school to learn a whole lot at that point in my life. So, and I actually remember seeing my teachers in high school and thinking, oh, whoa, that's not the way I want to spend my life. So I'd actually actively thought about not doing it. But in that moment, I don't know, it was a click. It was something. I went to the orientation and it was an amazing experience. This was the University of Maryland at College Park. Student teaching was great. And then before I transitioned to my current role as an instructional specialist, I was in the classroom for about 20 years teaching high school English. So whatever it was, it was a good moment, because it brought me to where I am today, and it's been beautiful.
So you have a new book coming out, Teach More, Hover Less. What drew you to writing?
Well, part of it is, you know, that link to English and teaching English. This is not always the case, but I tend to think that people who are avid readers are more likely to become avid writers. And, you know, over the years, I have done a lot of writing. Many, many years ago, I actually wrote a book and didn't do anything with it. I just wrote it for myself. It was kind of like I was angry. I write best when I'm angry. And it just flowed out of me. And then that was the end of it. I've blogged on different topics on and off over the past several years. But the actual writer thing happened because I taught creative writing for most of the time that I was in the classroom. It's my absolute favorite thing to do. It's a great class, and I love it so much that I have to work not to talk about it all the time. And in fact, I'm doing a presentation on it in the fall at the National Council for Teachers of English at their conference. So I'm really excited about that. But basically, the reason I love it so much is that it opens up student identity in a way that other classes that I taught or other experiences that I had didn't. So I was in my creative writing class one day and a student said to me, "Hey, you know, Ms. P, have you published something?" And it was this, again, like one of those moments where I think, no, I mean, nothing significant. And I felt a little ashamed, but then I decided to challenge myself and try something else. So it took a few months, but one day I sat down and I wrote about that class. I wrote about creative writing and I sent it into EdSurge and they took it. And I was like, hey, so I tried something else about student ownership of learning and I sent it to Edutopia and they took it. So what started happening was I just started to write and, you know, writers get rejected all the time. Not all my stuff was taken. Most of my stuff isn't. But eventually all of those early articles led to what became my book about giving students more choice and letting them have more of a pathway toward their own meaning of learning in the classroom. So it was a whole process that got me there. Long answer.
So tell us about the book and how did your experiences over the past couple of years shift what you thought about K-12 education?
So, you know, if you're teaching and your experiences don't shift, I start to worry because, you know, sometimes we talk to teachers and a lot of them, I think most of them acknowledge the importance of the continuous learning and the continuous growth. If I ever talk to someone who says, you know, I got this, that's when I start to think, I don't know, something's going to happen and what you thought to be true will not be true anymore. So, you know, that's part of it is that I've never thought that things were static. But on the very first chapter of my book, in my introduction, I talk about one of the big mind shifts I had where I assumed that due dates and deadlines were really important for students early in my career. You know, they had to have it done on time. And I never really stopped to think about why. And there was, you know, I remember this happened a few times where I'd have a student who didn't really attend my class or didn't really pay attention to my class, and they would take a test and do really well. And early on, I was kind of offended by this on a very personal level. Like, how dare they do well when they weren't tuned in with me in class? And it took me a while to realize that, first of all, nothing personal about that. Students meet us at different places when we're teaching them. And some of them came in not necessarily needing what I had to offer, but also not expressing that because maybe they didn't think it was polite, or maybe they just didn't care enough to, or whatever happened, right? So, you know, the idea that what was most important was that they learned the outcomes that I wanted them to achieve, that was a growth process for me. And part of what got me there was that I taught at a number of different schools or worked at a number of different schools where I would teach the same classes, but to different groups of kids who had different opportunity and access. And there were certain things that were different about the students' experiences and how they learned. But one thing that remained the same the whole time was that if I was giving them a lot of choice about how they learned, and if I was pulling back on these really rigid ideals of what I thought they needed to do based on my own experience growing up, which was antiquated at that point, the more successful I was. And that's what really started to shift how I looked at teaching and continues to shift. And I still think I'm figuring it out.
I'm a little sort of old school in a sense. And I'm not necessarily big on sort of dates per se, but if you as a teacher have, you know, you got turning grades. And no one wants to be at a certain point in the year where now you just struggling to grade a bunch of stuff to put in the grade book. And so that's where for me, it would be like, okay, I'm gonna give you a little grace period, but you gotta turn this in because your problem ain't gonna become my problem. You understand what I'm saying? So that's my thing when I hear teachers sort of say, oh, we don't need the deadlines or we can't get nobody a zero. And I'm like, you're going to get a zero because I can't make up something you don't turn nothing in. So you're getting a zero. I'm sorry. Because one of the things I think schools need to do is sort of, you know, prepare kids for adulthood in a way that they understand, like, yo, that's some stuff you got to do. Because unfortunately, the way high school is nowadays, for a lot of schools, I ain't gonna say all, we infantilize kids with how we teach, with how we approach, with what we give them in terms of here's some extra work so you pass, even though they didn't do the first credit and all this stuff. But school is over in the May, in the June, depending on when you start. And then if they go to college, 2 months, they're back in the game. But when they're in that game, it's a whole new territory because you got a syllabus and that's the law, right?
So, yeah, I mean, so there's a couple different things with that. The first thing is that, yes, there are dates at which grades are posted and there's nothing you can do about that. And when I was in a position of school leadership, I was never going to ask anybody to bend over backwards or to do something after or even close enough to a deadline where it becomes a hardship for teachers, because that's not fair and that's not a realistic expectation. But the way that I look at some of this is I think about my day, because, you know, we use the expression the real world or when students grow up and they're not there. And I'm not really sure if when we say the real world, what we say applies actually does. So, for example, when I woke up this morning, I had 5 things that had to happen before the day was over. When I wake up, the first thing I'd like to do is write. That's when my brain is clear. That's when my house is quiet. If you ask me to write later in the day, I can probably do it. I won't do it as well. It won't be done with as much skill or as much thoughtfulness. So if I have these 5 activities I need to do, I have to make a slideshow. I try to put them at points or to vary them so that they happen in a way that is working for me. And that's something that adults can do that kids can't. You know, we can figure out our work habits and try to make them work for us. And so what I really propose a lot of the time is that we try to build those opportunities, not all the time and not without the recognition that there's reality there, but also with the recognition that kids should have as many of those as they can, because it will probably help them be more successful, or at least it will help enough of them be more successful that we can get something out of that. And, you know, the other thing is I always thought it was so funny because, you know, with timeliness, we want kids to turn things in on time. But then, like, if you're in school leadership, do the adults turn their forms and their paperwork and their timesheets or their what have you in on time? So just making sure that we practice as we preach, because we want to make sure that what we expect from students is how we're behaving ourselves.
Hey, I hear you. I know it works that way. I work with adults right now. So, you know, I know sometimes things can be different. it was just one of those things that like sort of went to my mind when I hear people, you know, say things. I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be, I refuse to be that person that I see on Twitter who says, oh, I just have 100 papers to grade. And I'm like, oh no, that is not going to be me. Not toward the end of the year. Cause I'm already at this point now where I'm like, I'm just showing up so I don't get fined. You know what I'm saying? That's why I am at this point in the school year. So let's get into your book. You know, it's broken down into 4 stages, mindset, deeper relationships, planning for engagement, and choice-based instruction. What do you mean by mindset?
So in the context of my book, what that means is the beliefs that teachers have about what students can and cannot do. So it might relate to what students can learn, or it might relate to how much they can take on themselves of the learning. So I always envision when I think about mindset, I think about the teacher who wakes up with the flu and wants to call a sub, but doesn't do it. They you know, struggle into school. Maybe they're still wearing pajamas. They're barely getting there. And they work that day and every other day. And I am guilty of this too. I have done this pretty much my whole career, you know, prior to COVID, because they're afraid that if they're gone, nothing will happen. You know, no matter how detailed the sub plans are or how much they try to exert control from a distance, they feel like they've got to be there for kids to work. So the whole point of my book is to try to figure out how to stop micromanaging, because teachers work so hard. And there's these 4 steps that help them get there. And it's a very practical guide. So for example, the first chapter has a quiz that you can take, and it asks you questions about how you practice. And based on the answers, that's the level at which you might be hovering, or what I call helicopter teaching your students. And then there are other materials that you can use either by yourself or with your PLC or with your teaching team, where you identify the areas that you exert too much control, and then you start thinking about how you shift it over a little bit. So it's really about that trust. You trust kids to do anything that they need to do when you're not right next to them. And the reason that I started thinking about this a lot more, especially, was during those first 2 years of COVID, although I think it's been 2 years, but it feels like forever. So at least that first year, where we were all on Zoom and we couldn't be right next to students. And I kept hearing this over and over again. I can't pull a student into the hall, into my room from the hallway. So how am I going to get the work? It's like, okay, well, how do we do that? How do we help students and empower them to help themselves if we're always, you know, holding on that tightly? So that's what I mean by mindset. How do we believe? And also, we might say we believe that kids can do it, but do our actions contradict what we say we believe? And if so, how can we confront it and start making some changes?
So we always hear about the need for teachers to build relationships with students. And I got to admit, you know, I got my own take on it, especially when, you know, you're at the secondary level and you could have 150 kids, depending on, you know, where you are, what you're doing. And I look at that going like, look, it is what it is. I mean, you can have five kids and not like all those kids. Now, you may say, I love my children, but look, that middle one, if I could, I'd leave him on the side of the road. I mean, let's be real. I mean, when it comes to dealing with people, the dynamics of that differs. And when you're talking about 150 kids coming out in and out a day, that's an interesting mix of what can happen. So that's why I have my own little old take with relationships. For me, it's a matter of, are you showing up doing what you need to do? But other people, you know, they're like, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. So I'm definitely interested in what you're going to say about this. So where does a deeper relationship with students come into play, especially now when we're talking about a more hybrid, technology connected, integrated classroom, where we may be coming back now? Because for some folks, the pandemic is gone. I'm sorry, people, Rona is still here. She's like your mother-in-law who said she was gonna come for a week, who 3 months later, she's still there. So, okay, people. Woo. Okay, trauma. Okay, so, but we're back now, but the school district has already purchased that learning management system. They've already purchased those one-to-one devices and the Promethean panels and all of those things. So now that all of these things are in the mix, but we're back in person, where does that relationship actually come into play?
Okay, so the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to define what I mean when I say relationship, because it's very specific for the purpose of this whole hover-free instruction idea that I'm talking about. So in this case, I don't want to delegitimize this. When we think about relationships, we think about, you know, knowing what a kid's favorite food is, or having a conversation in the hallway before a class begins. And that's like a very traditional way to look at relationship, and it's super important. But as you say, you've got over 100 kids, and you also don't necessarily see them all in person. So now what? When I talk about relationships, I think about it in the context of whether kids feel safe sharing their voices in your classroom. Gotcha. So classic example, and I create a scenario like this in the book, where a teacher asks a question and a student raises her hand. And depending on how the teacher receives that answer, it can make all the difference. Suppose a kid answers a question and the teacher says, okay, and they move on to another kid. Seems very minor. It could totally stop that child from ever speaking again because they feel disregarded or ignored. Or even worse, if the teacher says something like, well, not exactly, who else has an idea? The issue with both of those responses is they don't validate what the kid is saying. Even if the child is wrong, you know, one of my favorite activities to do in a class is, you know, my favorite mistake. A kid says something, it's wrong. We use that as a learning opportunity. Or you have kids pair up and talk about it and think about what they say. So if you can find a way, and once again, I make specific suggestions to make sure that no matter what comes out of that child's mouth, they feel good about it, then you are building a relationship that's not built on, you know, whether you like pineapple on your pizza. It's built on whether they will ever comfortably contribute to your class from that point forward, because those little teeny tiny moments can have these huge, and this is the scary thing about being a teacher. You don't even know what happened. You have no idea you just hurt somebody because you weren't trying to. And because, you know, with an interaction with somebody else, a less sensitive person, an adult, it might never have happened. You don't know though. So the relationship is about making sure they can speak, because if students don't want to make those contributions, there's no chance you'll have a student-centered learning classroom. It just won't happen. So then when you think about the technology, you know, the technology is a means to an end. It's not an end. We've got all these things coming into our classrooms. We've got box lights, and we've got, you know, especially throughout COVID, oh, I've got Pear Deck and I've got Nearpod, and people think these are instructional strategies, and they're not. They're just a way that you teach. So then, you know, if you can use, if you're in a hybrid classroom and you've got a group of 5 kids at home and 10 kids in the classroom, you have to work really hard. And it's, you know, a lot of people have spoken about this, how it's a near impossibility to make sure those 5 kids at home don't feel completely invisible, and that they are finding ways to contribute to the classroom, that you're assigning buddy systems or figuring out how the technology can be maximized as opposed to just be something else, so that you can have those conversations. So it's not so much the technology, it's just how are you managing your classroom so that kids can be part of it.
Well, if you had the right tech, so I'm gonna speak on what you just talked about. If you had the right tech, it's easy to do. Mm-hmm. I'm just gonna say this because I've seen it done. The problem is folks get so caught up in gadgets that they don't just go with it. There's a teacher in our school district who when she sees me coming, sometimes you go, because she'll tell you, I'm not a tech person, Dr. Will. I don't like technology, Dr. Will. But I saw her teach that hybrid way, and I was like, I'm coming back to record your classroom because people need to see what you're doing. And essentially, her kids were in that Zoom, but she made them a part of the class. I mean, she literally taught like she would normally teach, because she was sharing everything on sharing the Promethean panel in that Zoom. The kids at home saw what the kids in the classroom saw. So everybody was saying the same stuff at the same time. But she would say, okay, Jimmy, what is the first step for number one? Jimmy at home. Jimmy will say, mm-hmm. Okay, we need to do the distributive property. Okay, all right. So Jimmy, what is that? Okay. Aaron's in the classroom. What do we do next? So now she's talking to both. She's talking to everybody at the same time. So she's not just looking at getting the kids at the screen, or talking to the laptop, forgetting the kids in the classroom. She's actually just teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love how you're providing that example, because that's what good teaching is. And then, you know, regardless of the technology, you'll figure it out. I mean, my own experience, not just as a teacher, but as a parent, some of the best teachers I saw with my own children at home during that height of the pandemic with Zoom, and then even after with the hybrid instruction, they were not the most tech savvy teachers, but they were most of the time veteran teachers who knew their stuff, and they figured out how to incorporate it, because that's, you need to be good at what you do. You need to have that dedication to engaging students. The technology, like I said, is just a way to do it.
It was awesome. I was like, got to record you. She was like, and then she's like, don't come back to my classroom, Dr. Will. She was like, don't come back. Uh-huh. But it was amazing just to see her, you know, do it, because she was just like awesome. We've heard so many teachers talk about let's go back to normal. And honestly, normal sucked for a lot of kids. I don't know. I just got to say it. I don't know what it. Listen, when you telling me you want to go back to normal and you knew your kids weren't doing well when they were there every day, when your school district is having Black and brown kids scoring 40% on state tests, and I'm not one of those people who puts everything on the state test. Quite honestly, I think we need to scale back a whole bunch on these tests. But when that's what you're hanging your hat on and 40%. I don't know why you talk about I want to go back to that. I don't know why you talking about, like, you know, this was the gold standard, because it wasn't. It was lead.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't working. Now, it was working for you because you were comfortable.
Well, right. And I think that's what it is, that people don't necessarily go back to something because they think it works. They go back to it because they don't know anything else. And it's the easiest thing to do.
Yes. So as we look at public education and what has transpired and the burnout that I'm thinking everybody facing, and the trauma from losing friends, losing loved ones, the disconnect of maybe not seeing friends or family, or feeling free to really, you know, go out, you know, because even the wife and I, we got our shots. We were like, hey, let's do a little something, you know. And then stuff started going up. And then I saw Sarah Palin, you know, go to a restaurant knowing she was positive. I told my wife, I said, ooh, who else is doing that? Who else know they positive and they going out? I said, girl, we ain't going out no more. So we got to went back into the house. And so with all those things that are going on, how should a teacher go about planning for engagement?
Yeah, and you know, I hear you on the burnout. It's not like teacher retention was doing so well before the pandemic. Kind of speaking to what you were saying, it was already in decline. And as you know, for the past year and a half, if you could retire, you retired. If you could resign, you resigned. So, you know, with all that in mind, you don't want to tell teachers that they aren't already working their behinds off to help kids, because they are. And they're doing some amazing things. And we're focused on, you know, I always call, you know, you're telling people what they should do. And a lot of the time they're doing some wonderful things. And if you don't acknowledge that and how hard people are working, you're alienating them and making them want to quit. So yes to everything you just said. And in terms of the, how do you plan for engagement? I think the students are such a huge part of this in a way that we don't necessarily think about. So for example, when we plan our lessons, we either plan by ourselves, if we're lone wolves, or we plan with some trusted colleagues. And that's how we plan for our lessons. And these days, or just in general, it might be easy to plan kind of like what you're talking about, the same thing you did last year or the year before or the year before, just because it's easier and you've done it and it's familiar. The thing we don't do ever is plan with students. I know that sounds really weird. How do you lesson plan with a student who's never taken the class? But there are ways to feel out where students are, to ask them questions about their learning, about what they want to learn, about how they feel. And, you know, in the chapter of the book that handles this, I have some planning templates and some handouts you can give kids that get more of their voice. Because one thing I think about is, you know, I was sitting in a teaching team a few years ago and they were talking about a book. And one of the teachers was saying, these kids are reading this book. It's the most amazing thing ever. I've never had so many kids read this book before. And they're, you know, coming up with all these hypotheses about why. I wonder why they're reading it. I wonder what's happening. And at one point, and I was in a leadership role, when they were, you know, on a little pause, I said, well, have you asked them why they're reading it? And, you know, it wasn't the most deep question. And it's one of those things that just kind of hangs out there sometimes. I think we're used to not asking. I think we're used to theorizing and interpreting and figuring it out. So the biggest thing for me for planning for engagement is pulling kids in as much as possible to the process and not guessing what they want. Now, you still have to teach what you have to teach, but you'll know a little bit more about what they already know and what they need to know if you ask some questions. And if you actually listen to the answers, and that's the other thing is when I teach, and right now I mainly teach adults, but every class I'm asking them how I'm doing, what they learned, what they want to be learning. And then I take that feedback and use it to build my next class. And I tell them, it's feedback on feedback. Hey, you said you wanted this. You said, we keep going into the same breakout rooms. I want level alike. I want this. I want that. Tonight we're doing that. And then they see, and they're much more likely to be engaged when they had a voice and how things are happening. And you're very transparent about how you did that.
I hear you. One of the things for me with teachers, and one that I always say, you can't, hold on, get myself in trouble. Okay. Nobody want to hear you talk for 45 minutes.
Mm.
Nobody.
Mm-mm.
Okay. Now your principal may sit there and be amazed by that, and they may give you a great number on your evaluation. But that just proves how badly they are at their jobs. I tell teachers, when we hear meeting kids where they are, people love to go, you know, they go to a diagnostic, they go to some kind of test score or something just because, oh, this, they're at this level, they're here and here. But I tell them, meeting kids where they are is understanding the world they live in. And this is where, when I talk about using technology, which is my job to teach you how to use it, is your kids are living in this world with technology and interacting with technology in this world in a far different way than you do, right? Mm-hmm. And even myself, I'm not on TikTok. Or Snapchat.
I'm trying to be, but I can't figure it out.
Or Snapchat. I'm just too, look, I'm 48. I don't have time for all of that. But I understand that this is where sort of kids interact. And for and even for me online, there are people that on Twitter, I'm like, yo, we are awesome. But I have, you know, varying degrees of what I call friendship. If all we do is communicate on Twitter, we can be like a little homie. But I'm not going to be like we friends. Like we need to be in a situation where we have met at a conference and we've had meals together and we talk on a regular basis or something, sharing some stuff. But not the kids. Boy, they get online. They're like, well, this is my friend. Like for them, this person is real. And I'm just like, look, that's just somebody on the internet. But the fact that these kids interact with technology in the world differently, to me, I tell teachers, now you need to think about that in terms of how you use technology in your classroom, how you actually engage your kids in the classroom, because these kids are not sit and get type of kids.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's both the challenge and the beauty of working with kids is that, yeah, we don't have the same perspective, but they keep us kind of younger, right? Like we have to learn about these things. Like I said, I'm trying to learn about TikTok. I'm not good at it. They're running circles around me, these children. But the fact that I'm just trying to figure it out, that's good for teachers too, just like cognitively keeping us on our toes about what's happening and how things are changing. And the fact that ed tech has changed so dramatically in the past 2 years, I mean, I know it happened because of the pandemic, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing. You know, we have opportunities we never had before.
It should have happened beforehand, but you know, unfortunately, it was a blessing. And I say this because there were school districts who didn't have the money, or they had the money but weren't going to spend it. But now the federal government was like, made it rain, and you had to spend the money on it. So now, I haven't done the research, so I can't say that every school district is one-to-one or every school district has a learning management system now, but I would say that a vast majority at this point, I would assume, would have it because, again, there was CARES money and ESSA money and all that stuff that was was thrown out there, so, and they had to reach these kids, so I would have hoped that they would have purchased, again, the Chromebooks, the MacBooks, the iPads, the Schoology and Canvas and all those things. So I'm hoping at this point they are looking forward to where school can be and not where school was, and not trying to use this technology to fit it in a box where it should not go.
I mean, I hope so too. I think the people who are being successful, who are seeing positive change, are doing what you described. And the people who are stuck see it more as a, let's try to fit this into what I already have. So it really depends on the school, the leadership, the approach. But yeah, I think that one great thing that we don't talk enough about is how much more access there is than there was. So I love it when we can celebrate something.
Hey, I am all for it. I really think, you know, and that's one of the issues. And speaking of access, you know, a lot of people talked about how some kids didn't have, let's say, internet at home. But also you look at sort of what device that you give them. Right now, giving them, let's say an iPad, for example, I don't know how much, if the school district could have paid for this without having to put a, putting on a garage sale, but you can buy an iPad with a cellular plan. Mm-hmm. Where those kids would have access at home. But again, I don't know how much more expensive that would be when mm-hmm. school districts were looking to buy devices. But that's the great thing about doing that. So we're getting to a close here, Miriam.
Oh my goodness.
We're just rolling around here. But I do want to ask you about the choice-based instruction, because we hear that so much, like so many buzzwords.
Mm-hmm.
On in education and on Twitter and Facebook, you know, it's just like when people had the little Bitmoji classroom and all of those things. And I literally, I'm not gonna say this because you know I still got a mortgage, but I was just like, where are these coming from? Like, oh my God, they're like everywhere. And so when you are thinking about choice-based instruction, it has to be more than a hyperdoc.
Okay, and yes, first of all, and I'm saying this as someone who really enjoys a good hyperdoc. I like to call it a playlist because that sounds more exciting. There are no hyperdocs in my book because that's not, again, that's a tool. It's not the actual approach, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we think about choice-based, yeah, we've got our hyperdocs and our learning menus and our choice boards, and those are all fantastic. But for me, it's, are you, once again, giving to the extent that you can, given mm-hmm. the constraints of your curriculum and your pacing and all that, are you giving kids opportunities to showcase their learning in ways that are meaningful to them? So, for example, if I have a project, do I have different pathways students could take for the project? Could they make their own podcast if they're a future Dr. Will? You know, could they do a different kind of presentation? Could they write something? You know, obviously, if I have an assignment where I'm trying to grade a student's writing, they can't create a piece of digital art. That's not going to fulfill the learning target for that assignment. So you can't always be like that. But what I'm proposing is that in as much of a way as you can, through careful scheduling and through just, you know, changing up the way that you instruct from day to day, you can provide those choices. So suppose by the end of the week, students have to do a certain number of things. There can be certain days of the week when they are working somewhat independently, as long as they're all moving toward that same goal. And that, as a teacher, frees you up a little bit to talk to individuals or to have smaller group instruction or to move about the cabin, as mm-hmm. I like to say, in a little bit more of a way that allows you to work without feeling like you're constantly talking. Because, you know, teachers, we work so hard. And, you know, especially when I was teaching all day, five a day, you know, which is kind of like the classic secondary load, that's 150 kids you talked about. Didn't matter how long I'd been teaching, you come home at the end of the day, everything is tired. Your voice is tired. Your body's tired. Your mind is tired. You have no time for your family, your own children, because you've given the best of yourself to what happens during the day. So if anything, the reason that I had to write this book about all the different strategies and ways that you can give those choices while still accomplishing your curriculum goals was to try to help teachers. Because one thing I've noticed is that since we've come back, so when people were on Zoom, especially they weren't as savvy about the different options they had, teacher-directed learning made a big comeback. Because here I am on Zoom, and there you are, and I'm just gonna tell you what to do because that's easier. And then we get back to classrooms and people are wearing masks and they're sitting 6 feet apart. And the teacher-directed learning just kept going because it just was the easiest thing to do. We're in a very unstable situation, hard to have students collaborate when their faces are covered and when they can't be near each other. And now here we are, and we're still having a hard time coming out of that. So we need to remind ourselves how to do these things. And that's what the different, you know, charts and graphs and literal exercise and activities that people can do. Most of this, you know, you might want a photocopy. I'm holding the book. I know it's audio. I'm holding the book, but it's got things in it that people can literally copy and use the next day. That's the whole point. Otherwise, professional development's useless.
That's all right. That's all right. Now, before we go, what is your advice to that teacher who is sitting at home? Hopefully, they're listening to this podcast. and they're thinking about writing a book. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them to not only encourage them to go ahead and take the leap, but sort of pitfalls to avoid, or any tips that would get them moving, mm-hmm. Instead of just going, well, I'm going to write this book, and they open up the that Google Doc and they just stare at it, and then they go, let me go get a snack. and they never get back to it. They never write that book.
I love snacks. I mean, they're snacks are a lot more fun than writing, and I love writing, but always a snack. So the first thing, encouragement wise, I believe strongly in teacher expertise. Okay. The people who are in the classrooms every day are the ones who know what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know that there's a lot of, they call this imposter syndrome out there right now, where people don't believe they have the expertise that they actually have. If you are working with kids and you are successful, write a book, because plenty of people want to know why you were successful and what you're doing. There can't be too much of that. I mean, teachers love to share. We don't call it stealing. We don't call it borrowing. We call it sharing. That's what we do. And writing is a great way to do that. And then from a practical perspective, and just because this worked for me, you know, start small, start short. Write some pieces, some shorter pieces. You know, submit them to publications. You know, the ones that we all know and love. Some of the ones that I've loved working with are, you know, I mentioned EdSurge and Edutopia, and also Education Week, ASCD. I work with Norton, they're my publisher. These are all wonderful organizations that have plenty of teacher published material. And they elevate that, they're proud of it, and they're so lovely. And you know, the thing is, if you have something to say, that's the big thing. Like that blank screen you talked about, if you are moved enough, and we teachers, we have plenty to be fired up about. I think that's why I write so much, because I'm always fired up about education. So it's like there's this unending, you know, pool of content to draw from. But, you know, you do that, you've got something to say, start with those shorter pieces. And what happened to me actually was that a publisher noticed my shorter pieces and said to me, hey, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I was like, hey, you know what? Actually, that's always been a dream. I would love to write a book. And now I've written two. My second one is actually about, it's called Lead Like a Teacher. It's coming out in 2023. And it's about being an instructional leader or a school leader by pulling in that teacher lens, so that you don't have that, what I call that empathy gap, that conflict that occurs between teachers and administrators. So, you know, once you've written a book, you know, you can do it. You don't feel like an imposter anymore, and you just keep going. So that's the advice that I would give to people is that, and also just be compassionate. More of what you write will be rejected than accepted. It's hard. No one likes it. You have to keep going.
All right. And go get your check. Go get your check. You know what this podcast is about, people. Go get your check and make sure that you listen to this podcast and learn how you can turn that book into presentations at conferences, speaking engagements, masterminds, consulting opportunities. Okay, people. You know, hey, I ain't playing about my coin. Can't do it. So thank you, Miriam, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
You're welcome, alhamdulillah. Now, people, you know how I do this. This podcast episode is going to be on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Simplecast, Stitcher, Spotify. Oh, still on Spotify. I got to get it all Spotify and Audible. So I need you to subscribe, and I need you to share it, and I need you to listen. And though I'm on all major podcast platforms, I'm trying to grow on Apple Podcasts. So people, don't just subscribe. Listen to it. Listen, share, leave me some comments. I need comments. I need ratings. I need reviews, because I'm trying to be found, and I'm trying to get Oprah on the show, because I want her to know that we're doing big things around here. Again, I'd like to thank my guest, Miriam Plotinsky, for coming on and dropping gems. And for you to checking out another episode of the Dr. Will Show, the Mobile University of Entrepreneurs. As always, people, invest in you. EDU. Peace.